To our live stream. I'm here today with art prof teaching artist Alex Rowe and Eloise Sherritt. If you guys would like to grow as an artist and you can't afford an art class, we've got everything you need here at Art Prof, critiques and tutorials. Today, what we're going to be talking about is what you need to know to be a freelance artist. Because I know for a lot of artists, freelance is a very appealing situation, both in terms of the types of gigs that you can get, and also I think the flexibility that a freelance life can provide you. But it's not really that simple. So to get started, Alex, can you explain to people exactly what being a freelance artist is?
Yeah, it's, of course, there are differences for every profession, be you a photographer, an illustrator in film or what have you. But in broader terms, freelance is essentially that you work for as a contractor for multiple different companies throughout your career. You're never tied to just one.
And Eloise, why would you want to work as a freelancer? What's appealing about that lifestyle?
Flexibility of schedule and self-determination to a certain extent, being able to choose your clients and your schedule as you please. And once you get to a certain point in your career.
There also are many gigs that simply only exist as freelance gigs. Like for example, Alex, in the illustration world, if you want to do, say, an illustration for the New York Times, the New York Times does not hire full-time illustrators. You have to work as a freelancer. Same thing with book gigs. You don't work as a company illustrator. You have to work freelance. And so part of it, I think, is understanding your industry and where the jobs are. Like Eloise, you work in film. So what are some examples of some freelance gigs you've done as a filmmaker?
I mean, any time that someone wants to get an event documented, for instance, like they're not going to employ a videographer, say, full time to be on staff and have them churning out videos on the regular. Usually someone will just be like, oh, I want my wedding filmed. And they hire you for a one off, or a job like a production house might decide that they're going to shoot a commercial, so they need to hire crew members, but they don't need the same crew members for every single project, so it doesn't make sense for them financially to keep those people on staff the entire time.
Yeah, and for me, I actually work as a freelancer in terms of lecturing. So I oftentimes do lectures on marketing, social media for artists, and so oftentimes it's an arts organization, or sometimes it's a local library, or it's a school. And so freelance can really be almost anything, but it does really depend on the field and what's really available. We have a question from Sue Ketchy. They say, can't you make more money in freelance depending what work you pick up? Well, Alex, why don't you take that question?
You definitely can, but the danger of that phrase is that the difference between like can and possibility and then the likelihood. If you Google right now the annual income of illustrators, it says 50,000. And I can say that I do not know an illustrator who makes that much a year. It is just like the reality of it is a lot more complex than that. Like I went to a children's book conference. This one was about a year ago. And there was a really phenomenal illustrator talking about how to plan your year financially, where they laid it out where, okay, so for every young adult job, you get say $4,000 to $7,000. For children's books, you get maybe 10 to 14, depending on the publishing house. Now, each publishing house only publishes maybe 5 to 7 books a year. Plus you as an illustrator can only make maybe 4 books a year. So if you add all that math up together, it's like, even if all the stars align, you're still pretty limited.
And that doesn't even begin to take into account the expenses associated with employing yourself, especially, this is just speaking for the United States, of course, but if you're self-employed, you need to pay for your own health insurance. And there's just all kinds of hidden costs associated with it. You know, if you're working the film industry, generally you'll have to provide your own gear. That's quite expensive. Insurance on that gear. Or if you're an artist, like a studio artist, you need to rent a studio, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think that's one concern that we want to talk about, because I know that at RISD, as a teacher, what I oftentimes saw with the seniors was people really holding up freelance as almost the holy grail of their art careers. Like everybody really was aspiring to be a freelancer because they really emphasize that lifestyle. But I'll tell you guys, there's a lot more that goes into being a freelancer than just getting the gigs. I mean, yes, it's so cool to illustrate the cover of the New Yorker. I mean, who wouldn't want to do something cool like that? But the thing is, there's so many other things that they just don't tell you about. And it bothers me because what happens every single year is I get seniors that graduate. They try out freelance for a year, they're exhausted, and then they call me in a panic saying, I don't get it. I thought that I was supposed to be better by now. I'm like, no, this is not you. This is the freelance life. It's really, really hard. Mm-hmm. We've got a question in the chat. Kishwar says, how do you plan for financial difficulties? Alex, mm-hmm. why don't you take that one?
I'm going to start with, honestly, the easiest one, which also has, I think, the biggest psychological barrier for artists who want to freelance, which is get a day job. And important caveat, do not let it be a source of shame for you. You know, like that is it. That's the easiest solution. Get a job that you are okay with, that fills your soul. Like I derived a lot of joy from working in coffee shops. I still do. And it gives me the flexibility where I can say, hey, I got a big job. I need to work like not at all next week. But also like, hey, the job pool's running dry, like fill me in full time.
Yeah. Well, so Eloise, how many people do you know right now who make 100% of their income, live on their own entirely on freelance? How many people would you say?
I mean, so I know some, but like the film industry again is basically like, especially in production, like it's almost entirely freelance. So like that's people's profession that they bring to the table. But definitely the people working in fine art or illustration and so forth, like I don't know anyone in those industries who's entirely supplementing their income that way. And a lot of people in film also have some kind of other job that they're working.
You bring up a really good point of income, where there's a good friend of mine and he's a freelance photographer. And he's a good freelance success story where he's been successfully full-time freelancing for 2 years now. And in his journey with that, he's a wedding photographer. So with pre-planning and things like that, beside that, basically in one day's worth of hard work, he'll make a couple thousand, which is right in there. That's that good buffer for rent and savings. And like you can sustain yourself that way. But for freelance illustration, with the exception of book jobs or really big magazine jobs, the prominent freelance gigs you'll get will be in like the mid to high hundreds, not thousands. So you got to do a couple of those a month to even like meet goals. So it's hard to get pools for savings.
And so definitely while you're in the early stages of your career, having that day job that can guarantee you rent and groceries every month is like going to make everything so much healthier for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I can tell you guys that I think I know about three people that are 100% on their freelance income. And you know something? They're famous. Okay, these are not just your average, I went to art school, I've been working. These are people who are like literally New Yorker cover all the time type of people. And mm-hmm. so you got to be pretty high up on the food chain to be able to do that 100%. Now, I think another thing to consider in terms of freelance is how incredibly inconsistent it can be, because what I have seen with a lot of my former students is a lot of them find that freelance is like feast or famine. Like, have you ever had that before, Alex?
Absolutely. There was a feast time. It was shortly after I moved to Colorado, and I had a freelance gig that was recurring monthly, which was like sweet. And then a couple jobs that came at the same time. And so it was 2 months of like, dude, this is just coming in. And then that well ran dry, as it does. And a note on that, like, that is a normal thing in the industry. Like, it's when you find a good client, they're not going to keep coming back to just you. Because think of it, if you're hiring an artist in this day and age, there are so many talented artists. You want to show as much work as you can. So it behooves everybody because it's more work for more artists and they could display more talent.
We've got a question in the chat from Scott. Do any of you have an idea how freelance carries over into the comic field, or for that matter, sequential art in general, like graphic novels? Alex, this is probably your territory. Sorry, Eloise, we will get to you in a little bit.
We need Kat also.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna lead with, is like, I can think of like three other people who would be better to address this than me. So I know a cursory amount where in comics, there are still staff comic book makers. I am 90% sure on that. But no, I think that for comic book making, there's a friend of mine in San Antonio, and comics is cool because you can realistically build up a following on social media. Like, I know everybody's aunt and uncle has told you on Thanksgiving, like, oh, why don't you get one of those Facebooks? Everyone will see your art on Facebooks. Like, that's not how it works. But for comics, when you can do a media that works with Instagram really well, you build up a following, you sell stickers, you have a Patreon, and that's a good source of income for graphic novelists.
Well, let's talk about how to actually get the freelance gig, because freelance gigs can come from you in all different directions. I mean, I honestly think the most powerful one is word of mouth. That's usually how I get my lecture gigs, is somebody sees me at a library, they're part of an artist organization, they tell their organization, hey, you should hire her. So word of mouth, I think, is very, very powerful. But sometimes you can actually just go ask for the gig. Like, I have done that. I have called up arts organizations and said, I have these lectures, I'm available, this is my fee. And honestly, a lot of the times they're like, sure. So it's really incredible that you can get yourself out there. Eloise, how have you gotten your freelance gigs? Word of mouth, social media, what's it been?
Word of mouth, mostly. And that's just a matter of like, being on the scene enough and meeting people and proving that you're competent. It's sort of an obnoxious toss-up, especially like when, rather than being able, when you don't have like a portfolio to show, you need to be able to show you can do the work in order to get the work. But then no one wants to pay you for the work if you can't show you can do the work. And so even though, I mean, I am like so against doing pro bono work by like necessity. I'm not against doing pro bono work for like nonprofits and organizers and that kind of thing. But I mean, in terms of like, oh, do it for exposure. It's like this horrible toss up where sometimes early in your career, you really do need to do that so that you can like sell yourself. Mm-hmm. But it shouldn't be that way. And the other thing is, I would say I did not care for networking events. I found that I was much more likely to get work from people who I met in other contexts, maybe something along the lines of like, if you're working in film, like maybe there's like a monthly film production, like collective group that like gets together and like workshops stuff. And then you meet people and you talk and you're able to be like, okay, you form a relationship that has nothing to do with like standing awkwardly with cocktails for half an hour speed dating.
Yeah, I would echo that 100%, because in going to like some children's books events that are much more networky based, it's like no one wants to be there. Like the art directors don't want to be talked to by illustrators that aren't comfortable talking to art directors. Like what is comfortable is like exactly like finding local figure drawing events, finding local groups that artists hang out. There's a lot of like drink and draw if you're like over 21 that are really good to participate. And that way you meet people in a casual setting where it's not, yeah, as you say, it's not like a speed dating.
Yeah.
We've got a question in the chat. Guy Harrison is saying, do you guys know freelancers in the visual effects career? How are they? I actually do. My husband has a friend who's been working in visual effects for many, many years. And I'll tell you, it's not pretty. Because basically what happens is you get assigned to a movie. You're working on it for, say, 3 or 4 months. And this friend of ours, she's moving between Vancouver, London, and New York City. So every few months, she gets up, moves to another city, project ends, moves to another city. I mean, the freelance life, you guys, if you want to have kids, this is not the lifestyle for you. I mean, I have kids and I would go insane if I had to do this. And it really is a lifestyle for somebody who already has support, maybe from their parents or something like that. And I just feel like everybody I know who does freelance has some other gig. It's extremely rare to just do entirely that. So yeah, the visual effects industry, it's a little bit scary. You're sort of this like refugee artist moving from city to city. It's really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. BV is saying, being responsible and competent is one of the most important things if you want a stable income from art. Do many factors, but those will take you pretty far. Well, what do you think about that, Eloise? Because being responsible and competent, of course, who doesn't want that? But is that really the only thing that gets you a freelance gig all the time?
It doesn't hurt, I'll tell you that, because you need to build a reputation. When you're a freelancer, your reputation is everything. I would say more often being responsible and competent is what will save you when the job goes south. Like, if you are really good at documenting your work and expenses and all these other things, making sure there are paper trails for everything. I mean, but in terms of getting the gig, I like charisma helps, like being able to be good with relationships and meeting new people and being confident is in many ways, like that's sort of fake it till you make it, mm-hmm. is kind of sometimes more than like being responsible and competent if like no one remembers you.
So yeah. Another aspect I think of the freelance life is the paperwork. Oh my God. It's like all those contracts, those invoices, the down payment, just making sure you get paid is actually a lot of work. Like I literally got a check in the mail yesterday for a lecture that I did in February. And the only reason I got that is because I keep detailed spreadsheets and I realized, hey, these people have not paid me. And I bothered them and they said, oh, we had this transition and we changed to a different manager. I'm like, I don't care, pay up. And so this is extremely common where you have to chase people to get paid. Has that been your experience, Alex?
Yep. Especially early on when I didn't know how to not only like cover my bases, but yeah, there's a little bit of like, I don't want to say read the room, but like check with the clients you're getting and see, like, you can kind of tell like, this one's not going to pay me, are they? Like, but yeah, like one of the first jobs, it was for like a restaurant chain, in a state and like, had to full on leave a voicemail that was like, hey, like I need my check or else I will pursue legal action. Which actually, Eloise, I know that you have a good point about how New York works with things like that, but.
Yes, so where you live is a very important thing to take into consideration because, I mean, definitely in the United States, I mean, I can't speak for other countries and I can't really even speak for many other states because we have like so many different local sets of laws. In New York City, this really important law was recently passed in, I think, like 2017, which is called the Freelance Isn't Free Act. And it basically made it so that all freelancers who are working above a certain amount of money are guaranteed a right to a written contract, protection from retaliation and also fair and timely full payment. And that seems so basic. And yet, and I mean, I think Lisa, who I think is in the chat today, has observed on many occasions that the thing I always come back to is get a contract. Because if you get a contract, not only does it protect you, but you can also put in a lot of stipulations for things like paying you within 30 days of invoicing. Yeah. And a kill fee if they decide that they want to like cancel your services like a week before, but you've already blocked off a huge amount of time. You could be like, well, sorry, you need to pay at least like 50% of what I was owed, if not full amount. So
I really recommend you guys, if you have not seen this video that we have, Business Tips for Visual Artists, we do go into things like kill fees and non-refundable deposits, all the nuts and bolts that you need to know, because, oh my goodness, people are so quick to abuse you as an artist. And honestly, half the time it's because they just don't even know, because a lot of the people that hire you, they're not artists. They're people in some marketing department in a company, or it's these people that work at a community center. They're usually not people that know anything about what's going on. We've got a comment here from BV. They've been a freelance artist for a few years. While your main gigs, building a base of reputation and artwork of your own is what can boost your solo career. Absolutely. I want to really point that out. I'm so glad you brought that up, BV, because you know something? Every time I work with a freelancer or somebody on a short-term basis, and if they're terrible, take a wild guess how many people I tell. Everybody. People will say, oh, what about, I'm like, don't hire them. They're the worst. They did this, this, and this, okay? Now on the flip side, if I work with somebody and they're terrific, I will also tell everybody I know, hire Lizzie, she's amazing. She did a great job for me. She's reliable. And so it's like what you said earlier, Eloise, your reputation really can make or break your freelance career, because it's a small world out there. We all know each other. I mean, Alex, have you ever been told this person's great or this person's terrible?
Oh yeah, like those, exactly, in those social settings of like word around the campfire, you'll hear that. You'll also hear that about clients, and you'll hear about which companies, like I've been in like sessions with illustrators where it's like one company will like consistently try to wiggle their way out of payment for everyone. And it's like, and they're surprisingly big companies too. And every time they're like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, like they'll pretend like it's the first time it happens. Yeah.
We've got some questions in the chat. Starving Artist is saying, what about 3D works? Sculptors, installations, jewelry, ceramics, and textiles. Absolutely. I mean, I know oftentimes there are lots of freelance sculptors, if they have some architectural feature, they need somebody to sculpt a gargoyle or, you know, something that goes on the side of a building. I know that some people do freelance work for places like Madame Tussauds, the wax museum. They'll just hire a freelancer to sculpt Benedict Cumberbatch or, you know.
Okay, Clara.
No, I'm just saying, I'm available, Madame Tussauds, if that ever comes up. Yeah, so it's not as common, I would say, as a film shoot, where you literally cannot make it without other people. But yes, those gigs are absolutely out there. And Neil was asking, I'm still in high school. They'll teach this stuff in school, right? I think I can't handle this all by myself. Alex, how much did your art school teach you about all this stuff?
All right, so I got some good news and some bad news for you. The good news is we're here now. Like, that's the good news. The bad news is, yeah, my art school experience very much glorified freelance. And I think that it's one of those funny things where it's like, part of it, yes, was me on a student. I think that I also glorified freelance as well. But it's that kind of thing of like, the student is not the adult in the room. Like, I needed the adults in the room to tell me these realistic things, like, cool, like health insurance, contracts, da-da-da-da-da. Some things that are really helpful as far as like tried and true. There's a book, it comes out every year because they make money too. The Graphic Artist Guild Handbook, Pricing and Ethical Guidelines. And that is a just good, it's about $50. So put it on your next Christmas list for your folks. And it is a really good resource. It has sample contracts, sample invoices, all the different pricing standards of like what to charge for. And it's one of those things, yeah, like no, school 9 times out of 10 will not teach you, but I think that life will, as hokey as that sounds. Like,
life comes at you hard.
Yeah, like, well, yeah, like, I mean, I learned a lot about how to operate business as a freelancer by getting to know owners at the coffee shops I've worked at and getting to know these small business owners and how they handle marketing, customer service, interaction, and building their business has taught me so much about how to build an art business.
I mean, I think to a certain degree, there's really a limit to how much you can teach this type of thing in school. Because I taught a senior seminar class at RISD twice, and it's for graduating seniors in printmaking. And I would tell them things like, guys, a contract is really important. And then they're like, yeah, yeah. And then they like call me a year, Clara, what? I'm like, I told you so many times. And it's like, it doesn't really become real until you seriously mess it up. I mean, Eloise and Alex, I'm sure the three of us have stories about stupid things we did as freelancers that as intelligent people, we probably should have known better, but you can't until you've actually screwed it up. I mean, I totally have done commissions where I did all this work and I didn't bother to get a down payment. I mean, that was so stupid looking back on it, but you don't know that until you actually have the crappy thing happen to you.
Yeah, and more so that weird irony too of like when I was fresh out of school and I wanted so badly to get a book job. I was not at the skill level nor at the emotional state to handle a work of that caliber. Like, and that's the ironic thing.
Eloise, we've got a question for you. Your mom is saying, what is the best way to build up success, gain popularity, and become known?
Well, if anyone has an answer for that, I would love to hear it. Call me. No, I'm sorry. Oh, Alex.
How do we do this, guys? How do you get known?
Yeah.
Is it just you go to parties, you set up an Instagram? Is that all it is?
You know, I think it, I'm thinking specifically of a friend of mine who does visual effects and matte paintings for films, and he is all about that hustle. He does CrossFit to relax and marathons. And like, Clara, when you're painting that lifestyle of going from LA to Vancouver to New York, like he loves it and he digs it. But then like I much more like having a dog on my couch. Like I like more of a hobbit paced lifestyle. And yeah, I think that you find that out and then you find out how to make success work for that.
And, yeah, it can be very tricky. And I will say the freelance lifestyle is not for everybody. And I do feel that a lot of art schools push, oh, if you're not freelancing and you have a gig doing something else, you're bad. And that's not true. Like you have to figure out the lifestyle that works for you. Like I would go insane if I had to move from LA to Vancouver to London all the time. Some people might really like it because they really enjoy the travel. I just don't think things are as black and white as freelance is the best. Everything else sucks. Like, I don't think it really works out that way.
Yeah. I mean, there is like sacrifices you have to make. I know that I think it was like 2018 through halfway through 2019. I think I was traveling like every month for some job or other. And I was so exhausted and I was always leaving. It was so difficult to build relationships or like feel like I was really planted just because I was never in one place long enough to catch my breath.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think, Alex, what you said earlier about the constant hustle. Okay, so I'm pretty well known around some of these areas for giving these lectures. And one thing that is cool about freelance, once you establish a connection with somebody at a company, it's so easy to come back a couple months later and say, hey, you want to run those lectures again this year? And then that's a no-brainer because you've already worked with them and it's a lot easier. And I know a lot of illustrators, you build up a relationship with the art director. The art director knows you. You know that they're not crazy. So it's like you do reap what you sow. It's just a freelance career. You don't build a freelance career in 2 months. I mean, even the people I know who were very successful, it took them a long time. It took them years to build up those relationships. So you have to be somebody who's willing to do that constant hustle, because if you're not, it's really not a good fit, in my opinion. Raphael Sanga is saying, I've heard something about, quote, unique selling point in design freelancing, but I don't know exactly what that is. Eloise, do you want to take a stab at that?
Unique selling point. I've never heard that.
Alex?
Wait, I'm going to Google it quickly.
I haven't heard it. Eloise, you said you're looking it up?
Yeah.
Cool. My guess would be that it's like kind of like that thing that makes you stand out.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's what it looks like. Yeah. No, that I just had never heard that specific phrase before. But yeah, I mean, that is total, like, I mean, what if you're like a, I mean, so if you're like a gaffer in the film industry, you know, you're the person who does the lights, right? And who is executing that. And like, people know that like you're the person for like a really like a specific kind of look that they want. Like, they'll tailor the people they hire to the jobs that they get. Likewise, you know, for, I'm sure for illustrators, it's like, you want to find out like, okay, so this person has an established style, or they specialize in doing graphic novels versus character design or concept art. You want to find out what people really specialize in, because those are, obviously you want to play to people's strengths.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I can definitely say that in illustration, being known for the illustrator that does that thing is a lot easier. Like, for example, Marshall Arisman, you guys should look him up. He's such a cool illustrator. He came to RISI to speak when I was a student, and he said, yep, basically, anytime someone gets shot or murdered, I get the call for the illustration gig, because that's what he's known for, is he's very grueling, harrowing images of people getting cut up or stabbed. Like, that's a typical Marshall Arisman illustration. And I think it's just about finding a way to make yourself stand out, because if you think about it, there's a lot of people that talk about, oh, here's how you develop a career as an artist, da 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 da. But actually, what I think is funny is a lot of people that do those lectures are not studio artists. They're people who are marketers who try to tailor themselves to it. And so my unique selling point is that I'm a bona fide studio artist who knows how to talk about marketing, and there are very few people out there who fit that profile. So my guess would be that's what you're talking about, that you're the person that people go to when they have this one really niche, specific thing that they want. Because the thing is, there's a million illustrators out there. And sometimes people get hired to like do somebody else. Like, sometimes there's a trendy illustration look, but maybe the person who started the trend is too expensive, so they get someone for less and say, do it like them. Like, did you ever hear that, Alex?
Can confirm. And that's not a new thing. Like, there were professors, there were lecturers, there were professional illustrators I've met who were active like a generation ago. That always works that way.
Mm-hmm. I want to also quickly say that sometimes your, I guess, unique selling point is that you are a generalist, right? Like, sometimes for certain jobs, you want people where their unique selling point is they can do that one thing really, really well. But sometimes what people are looking for in a freelancer is someone who can just kind of take the project and handle the entire thing from start to finish and see it through. Because, you know, a lot of times, like, agencies, whoever, are like fielding a lot of projects at once, and maybe they're at capacity and they need to just be able to be like, okay, you go take that, run with it, and bring it back with as little input from us aside from reviews as possible.
Yeah. There was a story.
Oh, go ahead, Alex.
No, read the comment.
We've got a comment from Michelle A. I know someone who started doing science museum art, now specializes in that for all different museums across the US. Is that what you mean? Exactly. That yeah. you are the person they need when they need a wax sculpture of Benedict Cumberbatch, you know? Like, you are the person who they go to, you know, just letting you know Madame Tussauds. Something like that, that you are known for is really a great way to go about doing it. Okay, guys, we have an Art Prof Share today that we would like to show you guys. Art Prof Share, if you don't know what it is when one of you guys makes an artwork in reaction to some of our content. Maybe it's a tutorial, maybe it's an article that you read. And the Art Prof Share that we're looking at today is by Marie-Louise Zeisig. I'm sorry if I don't know how to pronounce any of these names, but let me just read to you guys a little bit what Marie-Louise wrote to us about her art prof share. So she said she was watching my, I got to bring him up again, Benedict Cumberbatch drawing tutorial. And she said that this video inspired her to try to not get stuck in details and to use big, bold graphite stick and also to use the eraser as a drawing tool. Now, what I think is really cool about this is that Marie-Louise explains that she's an educated musician, singing teacher, and opera singer. And so she said that my way of drawing was like Mozart's way of composing, hasty, intense, focused, fast, and almost fiery. But Marie-Louise says that her way of drawing is more like Beethoven, slow, note by note, line by line. So she decided after watching my drawing stream that she was gonna try to draw like Mozart. And so she also dug in and watched some of my graphite videos. She said she really enjoyed the process. It was really intense and Mozart-like, and the result was beautiful to the core. So Alex, taking a look at Marie-Louise's portrait drawing, what do you think? How did she do?
Yeah, you can definitely see that vibrancy and that excitement in it, in the face area especially, like that, just so tender. And when she specified using the eraser as a drawing tool, that highlighted area in like under the eyes and on the bridge of the nose, like it makes such a wonderful space for the eyes to rest.
I'm really taken with the sensitivity, right? I think like the quality of the wrinkles is so, it's suggested, it's not overly articulated, but it's just very sensitive and tender, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that oftentimes whenever I see portraits, a lot of people really have trouble getting out of that like blank stare that you typically see. I call it the art school self-portrait face, where people are just staring right ahead with this blank look. And I just love how relaxed this portrait looks. I mean, I really feel that there's a gesture, there's a softness to it. Yeah. So I love this idea, the way Marie-Louise talked about the rhythm of drawing, because drawing really is, to me, a very physical motion. And how cool, I just love this analogy with Mozart and Beethoven. So really, really nice job, Marie-Louise, on this portrait drawing.
Now, Clara just looks guys.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Claire just likes being compared to Mozart.
I have no problem with that. That's cool. You guys can do that as much as you want. Anyway, if you guys would like to be considered for a YouTube shout out, just go to artprof.org, click on tutorials. And if you click on the purple button, you will come to the Art Prof Share submission form. Or if you guys want to just tag us on Instagram, just do hashtag Art Prof Share and at art.prof, and we'll take a look at it, because we love seeing the stuff you guys are making. I mean, this community is so productive, because speaking of Discord, Eloise, can you believe how many people are in there making stuff? It's like amazing.
It's so intimidating, you guys. You're so productive.
Actually, I get like art guilt, because I'm like, look at all these people. We're inspiring them to make all this stuff, and I'm not doing anything right now. So I'm like sort of jealous of the art prof community's productivity, but I guess that's a good thing, right?
But don't stop. Don't stop.
It's don't stop. Really no. This is good. I need to keep that art guilt to keep me motivated. Anyway, guys, we will be in Discord in a few minutes. We're going to hang out in the channel called Post Live Stream. So we'll be there in a little bit. subscribe to our channel and join the Art Prof family. And thank you so much to our top Patreon supporters who make all of this possible. Thank you to everybody in the chat for providing all of your super cool, witty, intelligent, art nerdy comments, because we love them. Everybody, please stay safe. We'll see you next time. Bye.